and this is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Sure, the French Revolution was a major world historical event, but what could that event, which began in 1789, have to do with today, with the gaping and destructive disparities between rich and poor, between the powerful and the disempowered? In a new book, Emmanuel Wallerstein argues that the French Revolution had a profound impact on the way people all over the globe considered and acted upon notions of equality and citizenship. Out of these efforts, he contends, emerged the three main ideologies of the modern world system: conservatism, liberalism, and radicalism. Emmanuel Wallerstein is a senior research scholar at Yale University and former distinguished professor of sociology at Binghamton University. He is the author of, among other things, The Modern World System, a multi-volume study of the emergence of capitalism, the fourth volume of which was recently published by University of California Press. When Emmanuel Wallerstein joined me last Friday to tape an interview in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I began by asking him about the period before the French Revolution and about what back then justified or explained the fact of inequalities in wealth and power among people.
It was considered the natural order of things, right? I mean, there was a hierarchy in the world. Traditionally, in the Western world, there was an aristocracy and lay people or non-aristocrats, and you were born into one or the other levels, and you remained in one of the other levels. Although there were some complicated ways of rising, but it, for most people, it was the normal order of things, and one didn't argue about it. It was what was expected.
Now, you write that the great symbolic gesture of the French Revolution was the insistence that titles no longer be used. What kinds of titles were rejected?
Well, not merely what we think of as aristocratic titles, but even Monsieur and Madame. That means literally my sire and my lady, and it was a sign of respect to elders or to people higher in the hierarchy. So symbolically, the French Revolutionary said, we can't use Monsieur and Madame anymore. Everybody is citoyen, citizen. And that was supposed to be very egalitarian. Everyone was citizen Jones, or citizen, I'm not even clear if they used their first name or their last name, but it was always with the preface, citizen. And that was mandated by the revolutionaries.
And what rights were citizens thought to have?
Well, that's, of course, one of the theories of the French Revolution. It had to do with sovereignty. Sovereignty actually is a kind of modern idea. It comes into existence in the 16th century. And sovereignty, which is a kind of statement of a full autonomy, had to reside in someone. And sovereignty normally resided in the sovereign, which was the king or the emperor or even the count or whatever, depending on what unit you were in. And one of the struggles from the 16th century to the 18th century was the aristocracy wanted, in on this sovereign rights. And so they were making various attempts to have it transferred to some legislative body which they controlled. What the French Revolution comes along and says is, no, sovereignty resides in the people. That's, of course, that really is a very revolutionary idea, that the people are the sovereign. But the problem with that comes immediately. So who are the people? And that turns out to be a very, very complicated question, which we haven't resolved to this day.
Well, you were suggesting that citizen was at least initially designed to be kind of an all-inclusive term.
That is right. Everybody was a citizen except everybody? Question mark. First of all, didn't you have to sort of be in the country? Didn't you have to sort of live there for a while? Well, the minute you get the concept of citizen, you get the concept of non-citizen. So who are the non-citizens? The aliens. So there's some national boundaries and people pass through and they are non-citizens. So they don't seem to have the rights of citizens. But it was more complicated than that. once you say that citizens have all the rights, they are sovereign, you don't really want to mean it. I mean, and that's so revolutionary. That means that the people can do anything. So almost immediately, people tried to qualify the idea of citizens. And from the beginning, people started making a kind of distinction between active and passive citizens. So passive citizens had the right to have social benefits and et cetera. But active citizens had the right to participate in making the decisions. So how do you make a distinction between who is an active citizen and who is a passive citizen? Well, to be an active citizen, you had to be capable, that's a very important idea, of exercising this. So who isn't capable? Well, they started deciding right away all sorts of people weren't capable. One of the immediate discussions in the first couple of years of the French Revolution was, are women capable? And the women kind of thought they were, but the men didn't think that women were capable. So they were ruled out. They were pushed into the category of passive citizens and not of active citizens. And, you know, once you start that, well, then are children active citizens? No. You had to be of a certain age. And then the question is, well, suppose you had no property. Were you capable of making judgments? And no, they said, no, you had to have a certain amount of property. You can argue about how much, but so immediately you started getting all sorts of people eliminated, and then there were people who were insane or otherwise thought not to be capable of response. So they all were pushed in. So we had this peculiar situation. The minute you said that everybody was a citizen, you wanted to annul it. You wanted to say it, and you wanted to annul it. And that starts the process by which we've been living for 200 years since then, because all the people who were passive citizens begin to argue that they ought to be active citizens. The women said, we ought to be active citizens. We want suffrage, for example. It takes a long time. In France itself, you don't get women's suffrage until the time of the Second World War. And in the United States, you don't get it till, 1913, I think, the Women's Suffrage Amendment, and so forth. So it's a long, long struggle to get women. And then there's the question of minorities. Minorities are a very, very tricky idea because it's a socially defined category. But in the United States, for example, this had to do with African Americans. It had to do with the indigenous populations, what were called then Native Americans. Remember that in the U.S. Constitution, African Americans, slaves, were not considered active citizens, but the slave owners wanted them to be counted towards their quota in the national parliament, so they were defined as three-fifths of a person. Mm. I mean, these are kind of crazy ideas, but there's been this struggle to end slavery, and then after you end slavery, in the case of African Americans in the United States, getting them actually the rights of real participation, as you know, it really doesn't come until the Civil Rights Act in the 1960s, and even after that, et cetera, et cetera. And to this day in the United States, we're fiddling with this in various ways, and people are being, we don't allow felons. Well, felons turn out to be heavily grouped in so-called minorities, which is a socially defined category, and eliminating felons from voting disfranchises a good portion of the population, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and of course, the working class as a whole was disfranchised by having property requirements. So there was a struggle to eliminate property requirements as a preface to active participation. So we have this peculiar, complicated relationship of proclaiming everybody equal in theory and then trying in practice to annul it and limiting participation, real participation, to a relatively small group, a dominant group within the social structure. The minorities could be defined by religion, they could be defined by language in some countries, they could be defined by race, of course, very important category, or some combination thereof. Every country has its own, the Catholics are a minority in X country, but the Protestants are a minority in Y country, and it didn't matter. There's always a dominant group, and there are always socially defined minorities. So this is the ongoing reality of the modern world system.
Emmanuel Wallerstein is senior research scholar at Yale University, author most recently of The Modern World System 4, Centrist Liberalism Triumphant, 1789 to 1914, recently published by University of California Press. Well, it almost sounds like, Emmanuel, if people in the French Revolution, the French revolutionaries, if they were proclaiming equality at the top of their lungs, and yet they didn't want everyone to be equal because they didn't consider everyone to be active citizens, then is it just a question of rhetoric? Were they just trying to get the masses going, to mobilize people by using a very high-sounding term without really meaning it?
No, it's almost schizophrenia. On the one hand, you want to insist on the people being sovereign because you don't want to say that the king or the ruler is sovereign, and you don't want to say that an aristocracy is sovereign. So you want to say that the people are sovereign. So there's a whole large group of the population who want to insist on the principle of the equality of everyone, but they don't really mean it because there are subcategories within that. So again, if you come back to the U.S. example, I mean, for a long time, what we really meant by the people being sovereign is we meant male WASPs, basically white Anglo-Saxon Protestants of a certain standing. And we wanted really that all those people be included in, but then not others. And of course, the others wanted to be included in. That's the political struggle, the ongoing political struggle that's been going on for 200 years in the United States, in France, and indeed throughout the world. A struggle that is not yet ended, because if you look at what's going on right now in the Occupy movements in the United States, in the Arab Spring and so forth, one large chunk of that is the demand of people who are de facto excluded from participation for full rights of participation. So the slogan, a very wonderful slogan, "We are the 99%," is another way of formulating the idea that if sovereignty isn't the people, it isn't in 20% of the people or 40% of the people, it's in 99% of the people or 100% of the people. And if you look around, you see people struggling over here for women's rights and over there for minority rights. That's a very big theme all over the place, in the United States, in the Arab world, in France to this day, etc. One of the things you have to notice about all these current movements is the revitalization of trade unions. It's, again, the working classes who are reassuming their status as working classes, demanding full participation and so forth.
Let's talk more about workers in France during the French Revolution. The National Assembly during the revolutionary years abolished workers' guilds. Was this anti-worker?
Well, very good question. Yes, sure. Of course, because workers' guilds were thinking of things like strikes or other methods of it was an organization of the working class. But of course, guilds were historically, right, of skilled workers. So there's already a subtle thing going on there. There are sort of people who aren't in the guilds who are the unskilled workers. Then there are the skilled workers demanding their rights. And indeed, abolishing guilds is one way of handling that. Now, notice one of the things we often talk about the French Revolution being Jacobin. Now, what does it mean to be Jacobin? Well, the Jacobins insisted on the fact that people are individuals and there's the state, and nothing in between. All rights to the citizen, but no rights to intermediate groups. So you couldn't have organized intermediate groups, and immediately guilds were seen as this kind of intermediate group. So we're going to abolish them. But when we abolish them and we abolish other kinds of intermediate groups, like religious identity groups, etc., to which we don't give any rights collectively, then, of course, we're creating a situation in which the 99% are relatively weak vis-a-vis, because they can't organize in any way. Now, to this day, again, we're talking about the whole business in Latin America of the indigenous populations who are have been rising up to say, we want rights as a group vis-a-vis the state, and not merely as individuals, because otherwise we're de facto excluded, is a protest against Jacobinism. All states, for the last 200 years, have been Jacobin in spirit. They've all wanted to homogenize their populations and eliminate the intermediate structures.
So if women during the French Revolution are considered incapable of being active citizens and then are therefore called passive citizens with many less rights and certainly no rights in terms of suffrage and the right to participate in decision-making and public policy-making. And if workers are hurt by laws passed by the National Assembly that prohibit them coming together in organizational forms, what about blacks? I mean, questions about citizenship also arose in relation to blacks, but there weren't many blacks in France proper at that time. So what's the record there?
Well, I mean, that was the whole issue of Haiti. Haiti was a colony of France at the time of the French Revolution. And of course, Haiti was a highly structured society with a white stratum at the top who ran large plantations. And there was a middle group of what we would now call mulattoes, people of mixed blood, if you want to call it that. And then there were the black slaves at the bottom. Now, initially, right after the French Revolution, the white upper stratum said, oh, wonderful, we want, you know, we want to participate, we want our rights, we want to send our delegates to the National Assembly, and so forth, and we want power turned over to us because we're citizens. And immediately the free mulattoes, that is non-slave mulatto, said, well, what about us? We want it too. At which point, the black slaves rebelled against both of them and actually were able for a short while to take over control in Haiti and proclaim Haiti a kind of independent black state. And that really blew people's minds. It blew people's minds not only in France, which basically finally sends troops there that capture the leader, bring him to France, he dies there, etc., and eliminates the blacks from their power. But it blows minds throughout the Western Hemisphere. The United States does not recognize Haiti as an independent country until something like 1856 or so. The people throughout Latin America who were rebelling against Simon Bolivar and et cetera, were terrified by the idea of Haiti, which as a black state, and they refused to recognize it. So there was a whole kind of global conspiracy against the black slaves in Haiti, which explains to this day Haiti's miserable situation and its problems. But the interesting thing, you see, is that all these other people who were yelling about freedom and about rights and so forth in France, in the United, what becomes the United States, in the Latin American, independent Latin American states are anti-Haiti because it's black.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Emmanuel Wallerstein joins me in our KPFA Berkeley studios. He was Distinguished Professor of Sociology at Binghamton University until his retirement in 1999. He is former president of the International Sociological Association, and he's a senior research scholar at Yale University. Emmanuel also writes an online biweekly commentary. We've put a link to his website on againstthegrain.org. So this concept of citizen and the kind of momentous struggles over who would be included in that category and who would not be included, how important was this concept to the polarization in politics between left, right, and center?
Well, the centrists, my book is subtitled Centrist Liberalism, and it's part of the argument of the book is that basically out of the French Revolution comes this sense of having to make decisions about how to handle the new explosion of populist sovereignty and, of course, of the idea, which is the second major idea that comes out, that change is normal. So basically we have conservatives who initially are horrified by the idea and in any case want to slow it down in every possible way. And we have radicals who say it's a wonderful idea and let's speed it up. And then you have the liberals who take a centrist position. Well, what's a centrist position? A centrist position is to say, yes, progress. Yes, we should move towards X, Y, and Z. But we have to do it carefully, and we have to do it handled by people who are competent to handle it, who have the skills to do this. And these people turn out to be well-educated people who can operate the governmental structures and the non-governmental structures to move slowly in the right direction, but not in such a way that it will upset the basic system in which we're living. And the centrist liberals turn out to be very effective. That's the basic argument of the book. They actually tame both the conservatives and the radicals after about 1848. The two extremes, they're really not very extreme, but the real left and the real right both begin to use language that turns out to be very similar to centrist liberals. And I call them becoming avatars of centrist liberalism. That's the basic argument of the book. And particularly they get stronger and stronger through the 19th century. At the time of the First World War, 1914, they're clearly dominant. And even after that, there are outbursts by radicals and outbursts by conservatives, but they get sort of pulled back into this centrist position. That isn't broken until 1968. So the centrist liberals are dominant. They control basically the political structures of the modern world. And as I say, that doesn't get broken until 1968. And that's one of the significances of 1968. We're not talking about 1968 right now, but it breaks this hold of centrist liberalism on what I call the geoculture of the world system.
And by a geoculture of the world system, Emmanuel Wallerstein means a set of ideas, values, and norms that were widely accepted throughout the system, throughout the world system, and that constrained social action thereafter. So the centrist liberals, right, they were disturbed by what the radicals were proposing in terms of dramatic political and social change, and they didn't necessarily like the conservative, the reactionary ideology on the other side. What kinds of strategies and tactics did centrist liberals take in order to contain radicalism in the sense of theorizing, in the sense of coming up with concepts and categories and perhaps even organizational schemes to press home their point that, well, equality may be equality in rhetoric, but we're certainly not going to give everybody equal rights?
Well, that isn't how they would have put it. They would have put it, and this is the strength of their argument, they would have put it, in the fullness of time, everyone will get there. So we move bit by bit. You hear this argument to this day. We're improving. It used to be worse, and it's getting better. And tomorrow it will be better still. So your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren will get there and just sort of have confidence that bit by bit by bit we'll make it. But don't rush things, because if you try to rush things, it hurts the possibility of making effective progress. And that line of argument turned out to be very persuasive. People did say, now we have women's suffrage. We didn't used to have women's suffrage. Now, in the United States, African Americans can vote. Of course, we still have all these other things, like famously the felon business, but other kinds of things that are keeping large numbers of people from voting. But it's better, isn't it? So this "it's better, isn't it" kind of argument is their basic line of argument. Now, in addition, then they try to, take over your minds through knowledge and the way knowledge is formulated and asserted and stated. So the rise of quantitative social science or quantitative knowledge in general as being superior, but that, of course, you have to have special skills to do that kind of thing, is part of this game in which they try to set the rules of social life and social action. And as I say, it has been largely successful. Now, if we come to the present day, it's in trouble. But from 1848, which is when I date the ability of the centrist liberals to sort of dominate the situation, to 1968, they were in very strong position. They were in particularly strong position in the strongest countries, in Great Britain, in France, in the United States, and so forth. And indeed, it becomes a sign of civilization, another term that they like to take control of, to create structures within other countries that replicate this. So the whole emphasis on representative institutions as opposed to other kinds of making decisions, the whole business of formal elections and so forth, which are choices every couple of years, of turning over power to a group who are the representatives, who then use their wisdom and judgment, right, to make these decisions on behalf of the population. This becomes a norm, and it's been a very successful one.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Emmanuel Wallerstein joins me in studio. He is senior research scholar in sociology at Yale University, author most recently of The Modern World System 4, Centrist Liberalism Triumphant 1789 to 1914. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org, as well as to Emmanuel's website. We'll take a short music break and return and speak more with Emmanuel. Please stay with us. Thank you.